Welcome to Digital Clarity Group's podcast. Today, I have a great treat because one of our own Digital Clarity Group analysts is joining, Robert Rose, principal analyst with our firm. And he is the author of a couple of books, one of which has just been published about 3 weeks ago in March of 2015. And this book has an intriguing title. It's called Experiences, the Seventh Era of Marketing. And so, Robert, welcome. And let me just kick it off by saying, can you please tell us why we're in the seventh era of marketing and maybe what the other eras were?
Sure. And thank you, Connie. It's awesome to be here. Of course, you and I know each other well. Indeed, yeah. So it's interesting because for those of us who were sort of classically trained at university for marketing, we were always taught about the five eras of marketing. And, going back 150 years, really, to the early 1800s, where we talked and learned about the trade era, which was, really just about selling the surplus of goods that we had. And moving through the sort of subsequent eras, including the production era, which was brought about by the Industrial Revolution, and then the sales era, which really started during the Great Depression and was really focused on sales and price, to the marketing department era, which really was marked in the early 40s all the way into the 60s, marked, with really what we know of as the Mad Men era, the explosion of Madison Avenue and the birth of product, place, price, and promotion as the four P's that marketers rallied around. Moving into the globalization of the late 70s and 80s, and even into the early 90s, with the marketing company era, which really brought about the idea of company as brand or brand promise with it. And then where the textbooks stop, usually university textbooks stop, is the what we're generally considered to be in now from the early 1990s is the relationship era, really kicked off, you can argue, with the book One-to-One Future by Dr. Martha Rogers and Don Peppers, which this One-to-One Future really brought about the idea of CRM, customer relationship management, convinced a guy by the name of Siebel to go out and start a company that would ultimately be back and reacquired by Oracle back in the day. And of course, now my contention myself and Carla Johnson, who's my incomparable co-author there, is that we're moving into a new era as we are now 20 years into this digital disruption that everything that the web has brought. The idea of creating customer experiences is really a new era of marketing and sort of a fundamental transformation of what the process of marketing is really all about.
That's interesting. Would it be fair to say the two eras might be blended? So you have the one-to-one era overlaid by the customer experiences that you're bringing to those one-to-one relationships? Or do you think we've really moved on beyond that and that the experience is hallmarked by something different?
Sure. I think, well, in the sort of full celebration of Clayton Christensen, you've got the sort of, this is an evolution or a process, not a moment in time. And alongside that, I think you've also got some of the well-worn and great practices of marketing have been brought through. You can even see, elements of the marketing department era. The four P's are still alive and well. Marketing company with brand being a central idea, the relationship era. I don't think we lose necessarily all of the attributes of the previous eras as we move into new eras. I think it really is a refocusing of marketing's purpose, the practice of marketing and its purpose. And so I would totally agree that it right now, certainly it's a blending. We are still in some cases myopically focused on social and developing relationships with consumers. But I think it's starting to evolve into this area where the relationship that brands have with consumers is at best complicated with privacy, data, the whole evolution of the complication and the power shift with consumers. I think it's making that relationship ever more complicated. And the idea of creating delightful experiences and quite frankly, focusing on as Dr. Tim Walters, our colleague, says, you know, the job's to be done. That idea is really advancing sort of the purpose of marketing in the business. So yeah, a blending for sure.
Yeah, it does take time to move through eras, and there's all this overlap and transition period. And intriguingly, you talk about in the book moving toward better practices that discovered in part by talking with a lot of global brands. And given that my whole life has been spent on best practices, I'm intrigued as to why better practices are better than best.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that they are. The idea behind calling them better practices is because, quite frankly, this is as much a journey of exploration, I think it is for all of us, is this, you know, I certainly haven't come back in a time machine and can tell you what's going to work. I what I know is from the experience that we've had with our enterprise clients and what we've seen work really are, if you take them on their own, they are a set of better practices that seem to work together. And so as I don't think they're best practices yet because they're so new. They are certainly better than what we're in some cases sort of flailing around. And this has everything to do with how we're dealing with contextualizing content and digital interfaces to the customer experiences that we're setting up where digital and the physical are merging together, and how we're dealing with content and mobile and all of the varying disruptions that we're having in our business. And so as we've spent the last literally 5 years working with so many customers, what we've seen is in pieces, various things working. Put together as we've done in the book as sort of a holistic methodology, it would be arrogant to call them best practices because they're just not proven yet. So that's why we call them better practices.
I see evolving practices for an evolving era.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Excellent. So one of the things that you emphasize is the need for content creation management, and you call that a core discipline for organizations to develop, and that is intriguing to me. So what do you mean by that, and how does it move you forward?
Sure. And it's an interesting thing because over the last decade, really, what most enterprises have been focused on is the governance of content through a process. And, you know, even going back to the early 2000s, we really only had one digital channel to think about, which was the website. And of course, now that has just exploded in our face, and we have so many different channels to allot for and create content for. And what's happened is as we've expanded sort of all of those touch points that the customers can now interact with us, the number and amount of content has just increased exponentially to the point where everyone now in the business has usually some form of content creation responsibility. The challenge is that most content creation is kind of everybody's job and nobody's job right now. There's no synthesized process or well-worn methodology for how content creation, not necessarily the management and governance of it, but the creation of it, is actually a process that can scale. And so what you end up with is organizations, marketing organizations, creating blogs or print magazines or social programs where they're just kind of making it up when they have time, which is creating this really ineffective, not very high quality content. And it's really hard to scale that, and it's just very, very messy. The idea of content creation management is to say, here are some methodologies that we might propose that you can think about reducing actually the amount of content that you're creating, but increase its quality through the idea of discrete focused customer experiences where you can start to provide a bit of scalability, measurability, and ultimately better quality for differentiating your business moving forward. So it's the idea of CCM ultimately is a proposed methodology for marketing to apply to itself to include this idea of content creation as part of its core competency.
You know, this is just too good for me to move to the next question. So I wanted to probe a little. First of all, let me preface it by saying I just did a bunch of interviews with organizations on how they deploy content management systems and have successful implementations. And I kept running into the content creation issue. And this example I'm about to share with you is typical of the kind of thing that was cropping up. This particular organization was, nonprofit, government, state and local government or something. It was a medical campus that was a research type of medical facility that had many buildings. And they wanted to help visitors navigate literally through the facility and the campus to find the right doctors and find the right lab places and so forth. And so they got their content management system and they realized they had no content and that the content resided in the heads of the physicians and the researchers and the people who in a million years would not create content. And they had a crisis. So they ended up hiring a digital agency to come in and help fill the void. And I was wondering, you know, is that an extreme case or does every organization have an element of this where the expertise resides in someone else's head who's not going to be a content creator?
You know, it's funny. It's such a common example. I hear that. So, I mean, that's especially true, as you know, in so many organizations where you've got a high degree of expertise. You know, so healthcare is a great, you know, example of that, where the subject matter experts have this content locked in their head and they know it, and sort of maybe even the first concentric circle of people around them know it, and everybody kind of knows it, but no one's ever really codified it into a way that would be consumable by a rank and file manager or even a consumer, you know, God forbid. You know, the opposite is also true. I find that where you've got an organization that can't, you know, just can't shut up, you know, they put in a content management system and everybody publishes stuff to the web. You know, I worked with one large enterprise company where, you know, they had seven products and, you know, 2,500 PDFs on their website talking about those seven products. And it's, you know, sometimes with the other extreme, you get a content management system in there and people just say, oh, there's a big red publish button, so publish everything. And then when they go in and try and monitor the quality or what they're actually creating on their website, they realize that they have this, you know, 50,000 or 75,000 page website that really has no meaning at all, because all they've done is, because they can publish it, they do. So it's sort of this, you know, basically with everybody sort of having the job, but nobody having the job of content creation, just to your point, you sort of end up with this, there's no institutional mandate for content to exist as a strategic asset. Therefore, in the case that you brought up, it doesn't. People just sort of know. Or in the case that I bring up, everybody does it. And so nobody has ownership of it. And so the quality of it is basically as good as the bell curve of the intelligence of the entire organization.
And the experience must be horrible customer outsider, because either there's nothing there or there's a flawed jumble of disorganized mess, really.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. It just becomes this mess of, you know, tone and language and, you know, and sometimes videos and pictures and bad stock art and, you know, all the rest of it is just, and it does not. And in fact, you can argue that there's no such thing really as neutral content, right? It's either going to have a positive effect on somebody's experience or it's going to have a negative effect on their perception and experience of your brand. And so, you know, it can't just be good enough, right? Putting out a piece of content that you think is neutral is actually a negative experience for someone.
Well, you know, you said a couple of phrases that I think are very germane to this discussion about content creation management, with the emphasis on management. video and photography and so forth, I would imagine that, hey, they're calling us. I would imagine that without someone really managing this, you could end up with way too much text and not enough new media types. And the tolerance, I think, that customers have for reading a lot of text is probably pretty low. Does that happen often?
Yeah, you know, that's such a great point. It's not, yeah, and it's when you don't have sort of an institutional method for content creation, not only do you end up with an imbalance, just as exactly as you said, with content types, whether it be video or imagery or infographics or text or PDFs or documents or, you know, whatever, but you also end up with this usually an imbalance against, you know, the personas or audiences that you're trying to reach. You usually end up with an imbalance of stuff like thought leadership versus the persuasive sales oriented content that we're trying to create. And so in so many cases, we talk to these enterprises where they're looking at their website and it's just a collection of content. It has no overriding strategic purpose. It's just the dumping ground for everything that relates to content that we could possibly produce, including thought leadership and including sales persuasive content and including branding content and including customer service. And is it any wonder that our customer arrives at the website and goes, I have no idea what I'm supposed to do here because it's just this giant morass of content?
Yeah, that is so interesting. And I think it's one reason why going to the website, when someone tells me, some business, I'm a customer, some business tells me, well, we have that on our website and you go to the website, I just kind of wither inside because
I don't
want to do that. I just want the answer. I don't want to go on a search. I want someone to tell me the answer.
Boy, that's such a great point. I mean, how often is it these days that you're on the, you call up on the phone, you call customer service on the phone, and the voice that comes on that basically tells you you're about to hold for a few minutes basically says, by the way, our website probably has the answer to your question. And your immediate reaction is, oh, my God, I don't want to go to the website because I don't want to search for this thing. That
exactly.
how we've completely reversed from 10 or 12 years ago where we would have immediately gone, oh, great, I can go to the website, this wonderful new thing called the website and find out the answer to my question. Of course I won't call in. But we've now made the website such this big problem that it's now less attractive than actually waiting on hold.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you also in the book address a very interesting thing because going back to the title isn't content. The title is experiences. And then it's
right.
How you use content to create experiences and what those experiences are like. Are they good? Are they bad? Are they so-so?
Right.
So one of the things that you look at is how experiences can be created, managed, scaled, promoted. And that I find intriguing. How do you do that?
It's really, you know, and this is truly at the heart of this shift in the marketing strategy, which is, you know, as marketers, we were trained, going back to the university thing, we were trained to describe value. That's our main purpose, right? We were, even going back to the classic four Ps, we were trained to figure out ever clever ways to describe the value of the product or service we were offering up in the marketplace. And what has really shifted in this creation of experiences of how we create content-driven experiences that will differentiate our business going forward is that we have to create value. As marketers, we have to actually create discrete, separated value from the product or service in the content or in the experience itself. And one of the really cool things that, and this is where the heart of content creation management, it really gets its guts, as it were, is this shift in the methodology of away from campaigns and tactics and front lines and back lines, sort of that war metaphor of marketing as it's always been, and much more into a product development methodology, where we look at agile methods of delivering and developing products, content-driven experiences as products as opposed to campaigns. And when we start looking at them as these products that will, you know, if we create them right, these experiences will not just last for a month or 6 weeks or however long our traditional campaign flight in quotes is, but rather are experiences that could ostensibly last forever. They, you know, they could be the thing that really drives us forward and differentiates the business. And you think of something like American Express's Open Forum, right? That's not a campaign. That's an actual experience for a community of people to actually exist and get value out of, that's completely separate from what American Express does as a business. And that's the real difference in the fundamental transition here, and the real new muscle that most marketers have to learn to exercise as a team is, how do we shift our processes in marketing to get out or add on to these campaign-oriented methodologies and into more of these product development methodologies?
You know, I love that. And I've been around this topic in this whole transition over the past 20 years, immersed in it. But the light bulb went off when you were talking, because what I began to see is a company creates a product or service, and they can just put that out there. They can do campaigns around it. They can, you know, drive the revenue up and launch new versions of the product and so forth. But it's like the product stands alone, and the campaign is sort of the support staff, if you will. Whereas, you know, the classic would be like Apple with its products. When you say that to me, given that I'm a big Apple customer, the services that Apple offers around its products are part of the product to me.
Yeah.
You know, so the Genius Bar and the store and the iTunes and the experience you have when you call them, to me, it's all part of, I bought this product and it came with all this stuff. And it isn't a campaign.
Yeah.
And it isn't a service. It's part of, it's intrinsic to the product.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, so now in the book, we take a step back, because we start quickly moving into, okay, is that really the purview of a marketing team, right? To create, like, just exactly what you're talking about, which is this idea of the Genius Bar and sort of the customer service experience and all of that. And there's, you know, it's definitely a, you know, in the traditional sense of Venn diagram, where there's definitely overlap there that we see, because not every single customer, you know, the thing that's been around forever, the CEM, right, you know, the management of the total customer experience, should be probably the purview of marketing. But they're blending very, very, you know, clearly, where something like the Genius Bar, or an experience that can be layered over the top of the product or service, can and probably should be the purview of marketing. You know, you think of something like, you know, just even something like the American Express Open Forum, right? That is really a marketing driven experience, but it's not necessarily a customer service experience that would be driven out of their customer service organization, and may not be considered part of a customer experience sort of, you know, solution set, I guess is maybe the right word. What I think is really important for marketing to understand is that this is a spectrum. You know, it's not sort of I was talking with one enterprise not too long ago where, you know, I was talking about the idea that, you know, Marriott has now completely, purchased and built a content studio where they're going to make feature films, and they're going to do long and short form content and documentaries. And they have said overtly that they want to be, you know, an experiential media brand for the next decade. And I've also talked about Red Bull and, you know, Coca-Cola and all of these, Nike and Kraft Foods and all of these companies that are really adopting these content driven experiences to sort of basically lay over the top of all of the products and services they're creating. And the one guy got up and he said, look, we have been making money this way for 100 years. We are not going to build a movie studio, and we're not going to build a newspaper in our business. As if that was the only choice, right? You either had to go all in and build a movie studio, or you couldn't do anything. And the key here is that businesses can create these experiences that lay over the top that are quite minimal, actually, in their scope and effort, but can add quite a lot of value. You know, that just something as simple as when I look at, like, there's a company, Indium, which does soldering equipment. And, you know, before I knew this company, I had no idea that there were 27 different flavors of solder out there, but there are. And they have an engineer, a product marketing person over the top of each one of these flavors of solder, and they do a blog. So this company has 27 different blogs related to the very specific niche of an individual flavor of soldering. And they get huge, their customers get huge value out of it because there's something there for them. And it's a differentiating piece for the business because now the customers of this solder know that they are that's where I go to learn about all of the new things with soldering. And that's to me, the real magic of what can be created with this, where marketing's remit changes from just describing the value to actually creating these really cool differentiating experiences that can really move the business.
That's fascinating. I mean, you can differentiate just about anything, even things that are commodities, if you think about it a different way. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, there's another angle that you have in the book that I was intrigued by, and it's that companies should strive to be more like media companies. So do you think we're all in the media business now to some extent?
I do, actually. Yeah. I mean, there's, I think that's the real, the sort of, it's the risk and the benefit of being able to aggregate and build your own audience. The strength of content and the content driven experiences is that we now as brands have the power and arguably the responsibility to start to build value with our customers through content-driven means. But it also means that everybody else is too. And so the rise of the noise across all the channels is, it's already just deafening. But it's not a discouragement of we shouldn't do it. It's actually an encouragement of we've got to get really good at it. And whether or not the business actually takes the bold step like Marriott does or like, for example, it was a Capital One that just bought Adaptive Path, a customer creation content driven agency to build in house these kinds of programs and customer experiences. Whether we take that kind of bold step or whether we just start building in small experiences that help a lead nurturing idea or drive a little bit of awareness or drive, a customer loyalty magazine or something that's very niche. But just very focused on driving value for our customers. I think in some ways, because of how media focused we are as a culture now, every business is in some way really transforming into a media business, a content business, with everything else they do as something that, quite frankly, can probably be copied. And that's really the differentiator out in the marketplace, how we actually create the experience that surrounds our product and service is really that differentiator. If you look at just what's happening in the disruption and startups of companies like Uber or Lyft or Airbnb, these are businesses that are creating a new experience across a very, very old business model, hotels and lodging. In the case of Airbnb and taxi services and delivery services, in the case of Uber and Lyft, and they're creating better customer experiences using content and using interfaces and digital as a way to do that and disrupt the system where their product or service is really just it's kind of what's always been. It's a really fascinating time.
It really is. And this has been so fascinating. I mean, I'm sure that listeners want to go out and get the book because it's compelling. it really is. I want to ask you one last question that's out of left field, but I'm hoping to double back and start from where we began, which was the seventh era of marketing. We really seeing the Internet of Things becoming a reality. And when this thing it takes off as opposed to is in the embryonic state, it's mind-boggling to consider how many things might become intelligent. Do you think that that's going to change the seventh era or swamp marketing organizations? Or do you think they'll be able to, you know, kind of ride with the tide?
The real answer to that is I don't know. I think certainly the new era of marketing as it exists right now is such that the Internet of Things is going to fundamentally transform how we go to market. Is that going to shorten the idea of this new era, extend it, change it? I don't know. I do know. I totally agree with you that it's going to fundamentally shift the way that we go to. I read some statistic, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, that said the Internet of Things is going to pull 90% of the cost out of light manufacturing, which means really, you know, if you start looking at consumer packaged goods companies and, you know, manufacturing companies, the way that they go to market and really differentiate themselves is going to have to fundamentally change. The other statistic, which you lay over the top of that, which becomes really interesting, is that in the next 5 or 10 years, more than 3 billion more people are going to get added to the internet. And of course, that opens up all kinds of new markets in sub-Saharan Africa and South America, but it also opens up this new entrepreneurial class of people who can come in and start designing products. You know, like, can you imagine a sunglasses designer or a toaster designer down in sub-Saharan Africa or South America who uploads their plans to a open marketplace where you can 3D print, you know, a simple pair of sunglasses? Now, all of a sudden, brands like Oakley and Ray-Ban and those kinds of companies are scrambling to figure out how they differentiate themselves. I think it's a really fascinating time full of quick change. And what the, you know, this is why we say at the very beginning of the book, this is an exploration, and we're hoping to explore it just like everybody else is.
Absolutely. So I'm sure in the back of your mind, you are busy thinking about the next book. I'm certain of that.
Yes. As they say, publisher perish. I am already indeed thinking about the next one. Thanks for bringing that up.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a real treat to have you here. And we will have many more discussions about the topics that you've raised. They're very, very relevant and very important. And so it's been so valuable to have you here. And thank you.
Always fun to talk to you, Connie. Always.
Thanks.
You have been listening to podcasts by Digital Clarity Group. Digital Clarity Group provides research, consulting, events, and advisory services to help business leaders navigate the digital transformation. For other podcasts or more information, please visit our website at www.digitalclaritygroup.com.